Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by those lovely people at Cooker. 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. I love my tap. You know I love my tap. As well as 100 degree boiling hot water, it does filtered, still, and sparkling water. Yeah, bubbles. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to get the boss on soon on this podcast. He's a top bloke, and he can tell you all about how the tap was invented. It was in the 70s, you know, Holland or the Netherlands, I believe. And yeah, I think it was early 70s as well. But it's an amazing bit of kit. But, you know, he can tell you all about it and how it all works. I think that'd be a good idea. Nice bloke as well. So I'll get him on soon. There's so much cool stuff about this tap. Anyway, if you can afford one, I recommend it. Go to cooker.co.uk for more information and to look at the styles. Quite a few different styles these days. It used to just be one or two, and now you got the black one. I love the black one. I tell you, if I was getting one, I think I'd get the black one if I was going to get a new one. I mean, right, on today's hour, I'm curious to know what it's like to be Adam Kay. It worked really well when I did what it's like to be Ben Miller. I found out nothing about him apart from the fact we're both into talking about philosophy, meditation, and obviously aliens. Maybe Adam Kay will be the same. Maybe I'll get him on aliens. Doubt it, but we'll give it a go. So Adam Kay was a doctor. He worked delivering babies. He left when he decided he didn't want to spend his life doing it. He was stressed out, run down, depressed. So he decided to become a comic and a writer. Then he wrote This Is Going to Hurt, a book based on the diary he kept whilst he was a doctor. It was funny. It was touching. It was informative. And it was just bloody brilliant. Everyone read it, including every member of my family and myself. He became a star. It was even turned into a very good TV show, which I thoroughly enjoyed. Adam then went on to write children's books on the body called Kay's Anatomy and followed up with Kay's Marvelous Medicine, which my daughter and all her friends absolutely loved. He's now back with a new book, Undoctored, more stories about his time as a doctor and, more importantly, life after it. It's a great read. Let's meet him. Here's Adam. Adam, hello. How are you today?
I'm very well, yes.
Good, that's great. I'm glad I've got a doctor in the house. I've been a bit poorly this week, I've had a little bit of a cold, so...
I've not worked as a doctor for 12 years. I only worked on labour wards, really. ask away, but...
Well, I've got this rash and...
Your life's in your hands, yeah.
Isn't that what happens, though, when you're a doctor? I think I've read this. I love the book, by the way, and we'll get onto that in a minute, but isn't that what happens when you're a doctor? Every time you go out, I think we actually mention it in this book, every time you go out, someone comes up to you and goes, oh, I've got this little ache, I've got this rash, I've got this...
There is some of it. I suspect with the GP staffing crisis at the moment, and sort of, and meaning the waiting times are what they are, that's probably happening more than ever. But I think my questions have dropped off a bit because I mostly worked in delivering babies and infertility clinics and things, and now I'm in my 40s. Fewer of my mates are going through that business anymore. So mercifully little now.
I love the bit in the book, though, where you got something wrong with you and you went, do you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go and see my GP rather than phone one of my friends who's a doctor.
Yeah. I mean, doctors make bad patients.
And your husband was like, you're actually going to go to a proper doctor rather than phone one of your mates? And you're like, yeah, sure. It's like, I just thought that was really funny. It's the nature of the beast, I suppose. Did you enjoy writing this book?
No. I found it really, really tough. There's lots of it I did enjoy writing. I enjoyed writing the funny bits and the silly bits and my usual disgusting bits. But there was some very personal, difficult stuff in there that was traumatic to get onto paper, traumatic to edit. And then I battled with myself a lot about whether it should actually stay in the book at all. I'm proud of it, and I think it's everything I wanted it to be. But it was a tough delivery.
I absolutely loved it. You've got some sort of knack, and it's so good. You've got a way that it's very hard to put your books down, and it's very, very easy to read them. And, you know, I'm not the greatest. I read so many books, especially for this podcast, and I read a lot of sort of philosophy and self-help and all that sort of stuff as well. And, you know, so it's really, I'm engaged in reading constantly. Your books just, they're very special, I think, in impossible to put them down and a pleasure to read. It's one of those things that you get home at night, like a Netflix series, where you think, oh, great, I've got a couple more chapters of Adam Kay's book I can get
through.
That's
really kind of you to say.
Are you conscious of the technique you're using to write these books? Is there a special way you're doing it?
I try to write fairly conversationally, and I use, you know, humor as much as I can. And I think that potentially helps. But the truth of it is, every sentence that you read in that book, I've rewritten, you know, 10 times to try and, you know, I speak to writers who are just starting out and doing their first book, and they say, oh, you know, how do you get your sentences like that, if they like my sentences? And the truth is, when I write the initial sentences, they're dog shit, and then I work on them, and I buff them up and sort them and play with them. So, but I'm glad it ends up being readable, because I think that I read a lot of books too, and there are some books that are just written a bit clever for me, where I think the writer is showing off, and here's some long words and clever constructions and weird metaphors that I know. And that never impresses me. And all it does is it weakens my reading experience. So I try to never fall down the trap of trying to make people think that I'm clever, and just hopefully write in a way that people enjoy, because they get a bit of humor in it, or there's a turn of phrase that might be interesting.
Don't you find though, and I don't want to get you here to slag off your industry, but don't you find, because I do read a lot of books and think, oh, fucking hell, just get on with it. There's quite a snobbiness to writing still, where, you know, people like you and Matt Haig have come along and absolutely just done these books, which, like, bam, here's the information. They're funny, they're comical, and people love them, and it's new and it's modern. It's kind of like the Netflix, you know, it's the new sort of book, where really easy to consume, funny, engaging, but there's still the old school who want to write Shakespeare. So I've just moved on slightly from Shakespeare. And it feels to me there's quite a lot of that still around. There's quite a lot of snobbiness out there in the world of literature.
There is a bit of it, and people who use popular as a negative term when it comes to books. Like, the sort of a really good book should only be accessible to about 15 people. I suspect that's, you know, that's their mindset. You have to have your, you know, your sort of postgraduate Oxbridge qualifications in order to be able to read a properly good book. But much like TV, this snobbishness there. And I think There's obviously an art to writing this sort of incredible literary fiction that wins all the big prizes. But there's also, albeit a different art, to writing a TV show or a book that people enjoy across the board. And as I'm never going to be the first one, I try and do the second one.
What I also like about your books, which I think they're important, I'm your number one fan here, by the way, today, is my kids have read your books, all three of them. Now, obviously, the two older ones, they're 20 now, they're at university. They read It's Gonna Hurt. What's that one called? Sorry, I've read it so many times. This Is Gonna Hurt. This Is Gonna Hurt. And my parents read that, and they both loved it. So there's those generations. And then my youngest daughter, 9, she's read your other two children's books, which she absolutely loves. Well, you've done more than two, but she's
read, I'm glad she read the children's book, not the adults book.
But also, not only are you educating us on the NHS, which is great, because sometimes I think people can get quite anti the doctors. Well, the government did that sort of job years ago of make us hate doctors and think they're overpaid. You know, I remember a few years ago, you actually do a letter to Mr. Hunt in your book,
is now inexplicably promoted to the second highest office in the country. So try not to think about that too much.
You met him, didn't you? You talk about it in your book. You met him, and you're not sure it went that well, did it?
Didn't go very well. But yeah. I do think there's a responsibility, if that's not too sort of wanky a word, to do something more than just entertain with a book. And hopefully my books do entertain, but I try to also make people think a bit, because so like for the kids' books, you know, hopefully they're drawn in by the promise on the cover of all this disgusting blood and poo and snot. But, you know, I'm actually teaching them all the stuff they need to know, not just for their biology science exams, but also for the stuff about real life, about neurodiversity and, you know, why they've got asthma and why their mate's got epilepsy and, you know, and about body image and smoking, all these things. So I can make them eat their greens, but hopefully in a subtle way. And with my adult books, sort of similar thing. So, you know, they are full of silly, funny, disgusting, but at the same time, I've got a point I want to make, even if it's in lower case. And I really love it when, you know, I get messages from people saying, you know, I read your book thinking it was this, and now I'm really engaged on topic Y, or it helped me on, you know, on topic Z. And I haven't had any letters saying they loved it from Jeremy Hunt, though. That didn't...
Do you think this constant changing of... government at the moment and prime ministers and everything that, I mean, the NHS must be just, they must, the people in the NHS must just look at government and think, look, we'll just get on without you. Just because it must be impossible to keep up with all the new ministers coming in, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And I think there's an extremely strong argument that you don't need the government wading in on something as crucial as the NHS. I don't have the exact answer, and I'm not, you know, I'm not a politician or any kind of, you know, policy person, but there must be a version where the NHS funding is independent, a bit like how the Bank of England is independent or something. So that, because I just think the biggest problem is these politicians, the current ones we've got, they're wondering about their jobs in 2 years' time. And I think something as crucial as our healthcare needs to be divorced from that. I think that needs to be thought of in the context of decades. And the big financial decisions need to be made by someone who isn't worrying, oh, but if I put that up, that tax up, then maybe I'll lose my job in, you know, in Warwickshire in 2 years. And it's bigger than that. I mean, you know, I like the concept of democracy and I like the concept of MPs and that all works. But there are just some bits where it feels it might just be getting in the way.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it needs to be ring-fenced and cross-party to try and run it. You're right. It needs long-term thinking, and governments can only do short-term thinking. And it's actually got worse because a prime minister can't even stay in his job for his or her job for the period of time they're in their job. So, and it's just, you know, being privy to the system and meeting lots of politicians in my life, it was all just a power game. Now it's that they all get into politics for the right reasons, I think, generally, and then when they're in there, they realize it's a completely different game. It's how do you keep your job and how do you get into power. And speaking to I won't mention who, but an MP years ago, he said, "I hate being in power. I preferred being in opposition." He was Labour. And I said, "Why is that?" And he said, "Well, in opposition, you can just be really true to yourself. As soon as you get into power, you have to toe the party line to stay in power."
Yeah.
And he goes, "That means you go into wars you don't want to go into, and you have to, you know, the whip gets you to vote on stuff that you don't believe in, but you have to do it for the party because the public have voted for the party." And you think, this is madness. You've got some
game.
You know, yes, you've got someone who's really, you know, has got all their morals in the right place. And yet they're not allowed to vote the way they want to vote on things because they've got to keep the party in power because their leader has gone on some sort of strange, you know, anyway, it's
and ultimately the people who suffer are the services and, you know, and the country. The other thing I find very weird is how they just move from job to job to job. So, you know, 3 weeks ago, I was, you know, the person in charge of the army, and now I'm in charge of telly, and now I'm in charge of health. It's literally like if it makes no sense at all. It's like if the Archbishop of Canterbury was previously, you know, running the prison service, and before that they were, you know, Lulu or something. It's not, it doesn't work. Surely there's enough people out there with skill set. Wouldn't it be brilliant if we looked at the person who is in charge of the health service in the government, and they totally knew what they were talking about because they used to work as a midwife or a nurse or a doctor, suddenly we'd be like, okay, well, maybe you do have some of the right ideas.
Yeah. I always say to my friends when they're talking about politicians, because, you know, we're old enough now, I'd say to a lot of them, would you employ them in your company? If you had a company, would you employ them? And they, you can see the look in their face as they're trying to support some politician or some prime minister, thinking, absolutely no way would I employ that person in my company to run my company. And yet we've got them, you know, high up in the country or running the country. It's,
yeah,
it's
there's a
bizarre
line in a Divine Comedy song. From the, I can't remember if it was in there, from an album, Fin de Siècle, years and years and years ago, where describes politicians as people you wouldn't leave your kids with, then being surprised when they, you know, when they act the way they act. But it's very depressing. But isn't that, that's not going to change. The system is going to be the system long after we're dead.
Well, I don't know, because I think, you know, nothing ever happens until it does. And there's only been, I think, 52, 53 prime ministers in our time. And obviously they're going at a rapid rate now. They don't have their jobs very long. And so it's only a few hundred years or whatever. And so, you know, things can change. I think we're reaching a tipping point at the moment. I think politics is completely broken. I was just looking at a load of kind of celebrity political journalists and stuff the other day online discussing how wonderful PMQs is because it holds government responsible and stuff, and they enjoy the game and seeing Rishi Starmer now, it's so exciting. And I look at it like I imagine most of the general public do and go, what a load of childish bollocks. Nothing is being achieved. Just a load of people shouting each other. You know, I interviewed Harriet Harman on this podcast, and I really warmed her, by the way. I thought she was wonderful. And she did, her and her government at the time did a lot of important things, and they were good, I thought, especially with the equality laws and stuff like that. But she said, and I went to PMQs in her book, she says, and I sort of won that day. You don't win in politics. This is our lives. It's the NHS you're talking about. There's no bloody winning. And it's like, you know, and you listen to them, and they go, oh, Rishi came up with this great line, or Starmer came up with this great line. It's not a fucking comedy club. It's our lives. And then
absolutely,
when I've spoken to a few people, you know, political commentators, they said, well, we don't want it boring like the European Parliament or some of the parliaments in Europe and the rest of the country, where they will just stand there and, you know, talk to each other. It's like, yes, we do. It's not an exciting job. The first thing I'd do if I became a leader of this country, if I became King Charles III, the first thing I'd do is move Parliament to Newcastle and then see how many of them want to work actually as the job when you put it right up. Not saying anything's wrong with Newcastle, by the way. It's fantastic up there. Big market, is a lot of fun and everything else. But a lot of these politicians like their life in London, don't they? And they can be bothered to turn up when they want to turn up and all that stuff. They like going to Parliament and shouting and screaming at each other and doing all that. And it's like, no, let's try and turn it into an adult job here.
Yeah. Absolutely. It's too London centric. And here's the thing: I'd change if you're off shift for a couple of weeks, and I can be ruler of the country for a bit. I think in PMQs they have to be obliged to answer the questions they're asked, because the whole game seems to be someone asks a difficult question, and it's all about twisting it round and answering a totally different question and then slagging that person off. But this is Parliament. You know, we're paying for you to represent us and do your jobs, and it seems totally acceptable to just not answer a question. I mean, fair enough, there's clearly an art to it if you're being asked a tricky question by a journalist, but, you know, I think they should still answer them, but they're never going to. But in Parliament, answer the question, come on.
Yeah. Well, that's the job of the speaker, really. I think the speaker should be going to them, should be saying, no, Boris, you've been asked that question. Or I'm using Boris because Boris realised you can just make up answers.
Yeah.
And you don't have to answer anything. And just, you can just say, no, I didn't go to a party. Oh, it turns out you did. Yeah, wow. You know, yeah, I did, but I didn't. Oh, I'm really sorry. Let's move on to the next bit. He realized that you can just say whatever you want and your popularity rating doesn't go down. It's absolutely insane. But talking about the journalist by the... Go on, sorry.
No, sorry to interrupt, but I think people like Boris and Rees-Mogg I think they're idiots, but they're just quite good at speaking and convincing people that they're clever because they've been brought up in a system that teaches you the flowery verbose language. But actually, they're often never saying anything, or they're saying something that's quite, you know, sort of banal. But
yeah,
I think we've been tricked by, deliberately tricked by people like that.
Well, I've never met Boris Johnson or Jacob Rees-Mogg, so I can't. I saw Boris Johnson once at an ice skating rink, bizarrely. Well, no, it wasn't. It was at Westfield. They had an ice skating rink, and I was ice skating with my kids, and he was on the edge. He'd come down as what was he, Mayor of London or whatever.
He came. He strikes me as a natural, graceful ice skater. I'm sure that was a beautiful sight.
He didn't actually go on the ice, sadly, because I would have really liked to see that. But I had Jamie Lang on this podcast, and Jamie Lang, it was brilliant, actually, because he said he went to boarding school, and he said he's something like this. He said his mum dropped him off, and then he looked around and he thought, well, she is going to come and pick me up, isn't she? And it's like, because she actually left me there, and I was suddenly like stuck at boarding school, and I had no one to, you know, I was just there on my own, and I'd lost my mum and dad. And I said, was it good? And he goes, no, it's horrific. I was at this boarding school, and I didn't want to be there, and I was homesick and all that. But he said the one thing that boarding school was amazing for that he was taught was every single week or month or whatever, they would have to get up in front of the whole school and talk. And he said, you soon learn the confidence, because there's no other way of doing it, that you can't not stand up in front of the school and actually perform. And so he's able to be very comfortable when you put him on TV or anywhere, because he's used to it. Whereas, you know, like the kids like me went to the sort of state school, we never had to get up in front of the class, apart from every now and then we'd have to go and pick up a medal or something, or we'd done a drawing or something and the school would clap. You'd never have to talk in front of a school. And I'm still terrified of public speaking, so I didn't get that education at school. And when you look at Jacob Rees-Mogg and Boris, I imagine they were having to do that constantly. Wasn't Boris head of the debating team or something? So they become very good at it. So, you know, that's one of their skills.
Yeah. Don't like it. I mean, I went to a private school, but I was a much less fancy one than Jamie did, and I only went during the day. It wasn't a boarder, but I was educated in an all boys school, which I thought was I just can't get over how fucked up that is as a concept, that we think is acceptable. That the first time I actually spoke to girls who weren't first degree relatives of mine was when I went to university when I was 18. Shouldn't half the function of school be, you know, here's the maths and the English you need to know in order to be equipped to live your life? The other half has to be, you're about to go out in the world, you need to be socially prepared for it. And I was very good at chess and the harpsichord, but that isn't quite enough, is it?
Well, do you know what? You say that's really funny. There's a bit in your book where you were said you're at your school and you're at wine tasting classes or something. And I was like, what the?
That was a disaster, wine tasting. So, I mean, which does sound, it sounds quite weird now, doesn't it? But so from like 15 or 16 all the way through to 18, every Friday afternoon, a teacher would, you know, take us into the old library where a bunch of us would just get hammered. And I don't know quite what his motivations were for getting all these teenagers hammered, but anyway, the biggest, I never learned anything about wine, but it did mean that when I went to university, I'd been drinking like 60, 70 pound bottles of wine. That was my introduction to wine. I didn't know anything about it, but all I did know was when I started drinking the sort of university plonk and the, you know, the Black Tower and the Blue Nun, I think it was tasted disgusting. It's only now I can just about afford the sort of wine I was drinking when I was a teenager.
Oh my God, that's hysterical. By the way, I read a book once called The Choice Paradox, and I think it was called that. And basically, to summarize the book for you is, if you're always going for the best, then you'll never be happy. Go for what's okay and you'll be fine. So you go, I need a car, I'll go for one which is okay, that will make you happy. If you go for the best one, you'll never find the best one, because there's no such thing. But in it,
I'm too mean to ever go for the best one, so maybe that's making me secretly happy.
I think it was in this book, or I read it somewhere else. I read so much stuff, but someone said the worst decision any parent can make is on scores, and they were saying it's an unfair decision. Now, I've talked about scores a lot on this podcast. I just went to a state school, left at 16, blah, 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 whatever. Doesn't make me any sort of hero, makes me a bit stupid, really. If I'd gone to your school, I'd have probably been prime minister now, Adam. I wouldn't have wasted it like you have. No, you're brilliant. You're a brilliant writer, and you went on to become a doctor and everything. But, you know, the idea of having schools, segregating children, is such a bizarre concept in society. So same-sex schools, you're right. Faith schools, unbelievable. Private scores, just incredible. Yeah. Grammar scores. Let's get all the clever kids and stick them in one go. You know, all these things. And by the way, my kids have been to all this whole genre of schools. So I know about them all. And I just still think the best idea is to stick a school in the community, have everyone join in, and sex, you know, religion, intelligence, they should all go to the same bloody school, because when they leave, that's what they're going to be dealt with. And also, I think it's good. Now, if you're a parent, though, the nightmare is, so your parents, they're thinking, what is the best thing I can do? And obviously, yeah, the best thing that you can do is send your kids to a private education. So I don't hate any parents who do it. But in Finland, they got rid of it. They kind of said the schools could not have charitable status anymore, and they couldn't, and the schools couldn't run for profit. So it kind of, the private schools couldn't run for profit. So they just kind of dwindled out.
Yeah.
And their education's the best in the world. It doesn't take a rocket scientist, yeah, or a good teacher, a good headmaster, to realize that you stick all the kids together, it's going to be beneficial for the country, whatever way you do it. And then also you can adjust all the finances to get the shittier schools up, so that all the schools can sort of run on the same way. And it just seems madness that we're still doing that. And I feel sorry for parents if they've got a few quid, because they don't really want to spend the money. Look at Rishi Sunak. His parents apparently weren't that wealthy, but they were spending £46,000 a year. That's net on his education. It's, yeah, unbelievable. I mean, £46,000. Where are they getting the money from?
Anyway. Yeah, it's really rocking. And it really ties into medicine as well. And I think that medicine for a very long time has been the preserve of the posh, and this sort of doctor who tells you what to do and you listen to them because they're wearing a three-piece suit, and it's obviously a lot better now, but still the system is quite geared to keeping it a bit posh. So like, to get into medical school, you need three things. You need a bunch of good A-levels, you need extracurricular activities, and you need to have done work experience. And so A-levels, fair enough. You don't want your doctors to be actively stupid, but at the same time, you don't need to be that smart to be a doctor. It's memorizing a big list of stuff, spotting some patterns. It isn't, you know, you're not doing, you know, mega research. And it's a job where you actually need to be communicators. And so the best communicators are the people who, you know, have a rapport with their patients. And how can you have a rapport with all of society if the doctors represent like the top 20%, inverted commas, top, the ones who go to the rarefied institutions? And then they want you to have all these extracurricular activities. And, I learned how to play the piano and the saxophone, the harpsichord, trombone. I was editor of my school newspaper. I did all of these things a medical school want, but I had those opportunities just handed to me because I went to the sort of school that had all of that available. And I'm aware, obviously, that schools with fewer resources can't offer that. And then work experience. Most kids, the only doctor they know is the person they go to see when they, you know, when they've, you know, hurt their shoulder or need a new inhaler or whatever it is. The sort of people whose parents are already mates with surgeons and can say, oh, well, you know, why don't you take Charlie for a couple of weeks so he can get his work experience? You're just getting a certain corner of society who've gone to these schools that are sausage factories to churn out yet more doctors. And we need to, it's getting a bit better, but we need to really broaden it out.
Yeah, that, well, you talk about that in the book, and it's fantastic. What can we do about that, though? I mean, it's just changing. The problem with Britain, really, is we've got this infrastructure in look at our politics, for instance. You know, most of them have been privately educated. Harrow, Eton, and Winchester College have massive influence over our political system, and also the city and our judicial system. You know, all these things. So it's very hard to change that, isn't it? Because understandably, people don't really want to get rid of their money and their power, do they? So, you know,
No, I don't,
you can't blame them. They're only human. They're not going to go, hey, I tell you what, I'm going to give away everything I've got here to you guys. It doesn't really work like that. So it's a slow process, but I know
about medicine. I don't know anything about politics or the law or anything, but for medicine, if you made the following changes, if you really dropped the A-level requirements from AAAA to BBBC or something, that would widen out the pool of people who can apply. I would get rid of the way that you need to be captain of the lacrosse team or something. And I would get rid of the work experience requirement. And I would put everything onto the interview. So the doctors are asked, you know, the doctors who are interviewing are asking basically the question, are you going to be a good communicator? Are you the sort of person I would like to see, you know, looking after me, looking after my family? And I think if you did, and the other thing I would do actually is I would change the age you apply. I would make medicine postgraduate. So you do a few years doing a degree in whatever you like they do in America, the only thing of American medicine I would take. And then you join medical school when you're 21. I'd make sure the funding works, so because at the moment it's really expensive. Most people can't afford to be postgraduate doctors, but sort that out, because then you know what you're getting yourself into. And I think one of the big problems with people, including me, going to medical school is I did not know what the job was going to involve. No one had told me. And I think you have to know what the job is.
Yeah, and I suppose it's a bit of a problem, because when we turn up, I'm 100% on the side of the doctors, by the way, in the NHS, but you turn up sometimes and you have to have this assumption that the person you're talking to knows their stuff, because you can't do it any other way, can you? And recently I was at a hospital, something happened to me, and then I found out the person was just covering and really didn't know anything about it. And she was very honest, said, I really don't know, I'm going to have to go and ask, because I really don't know anything about this department, I'm just covering today. And oh, good on her for saying that, actually. And I was like, okay, fine. But then she wrote something on it, and afterwards I had to go and see an expert afterwards. And when I went to see the expert, they said, not really, no. But you have to have this assumption that the person you're seeing really knows their stuff. And that's the only way we can deal with the NHS, isn't it? That's the only way you can go to the hospital or to a doctor's or whatever.
Yeah, you know, we need to be training people upright. You know, sometimes we get into a situation where because there's such a huge staffing crisis, people, you know, do end up being spread too thin or covering a department they might not always cover. So, you know, it ultimately comes down to a systemic issue. But medical training is good. Medical schools are good. We just need a lot more people coming through, and we need to be retaining them a lot better. But the idea of doctor knows best is dangerous, because quite often it leads to people. I mean, good on that junior doctor who said, I don't know, I'm going to get help. Because historically, it was a culture of, I must not let anyone know that I don't know best. And people would blag and bluff. And that's how mistakes can happen. Right. And so it's bad for patients if doctor knows best. Because also doctor knows best says, I am telling you, I inform you that this is the plan of management. That's not how it's meant to work. The way it should work is, you're the patient, it's up to you, but here are some options and these are the pros and cons of each of them. And if you talk someone through something like that, rather than pretending you're some sort of all-powerful figure, it really, really increases the chances that the patient will actually want to have this management plan and then actually go along with it and then actually get better. Because say they choose what the doctor thinks is the second best option, but they actually go along with it, that's an awful lot better than choosing the first best option, then immediately abandoning it. And also it's bad for the doctors, weirdly, to be told that they know best. Because if you're trained to be this sort of figure who is sort of, you're the great doctor, then you think you can never make a mistake, which is dangerous. But also, you start to think that you can't get sick and you can't get sad. But doctors do need to remember exactly how human they are and all that involved, because every doctor gets sick and every doctor gets sad. When you get sick, you know, traditionally, you know, you would just soldier on doing a really bad job when you're firing on a quarter of a cylinder, and you would have to, if you did take sick leave, you would have to swap it with someone else so that, you know, no one really knew that you'd taken sick leave. And in terms of getting sad, there's a huge crisis in the mental health of doctors, boiling down to the fact that we pretend that everything's fine.
Yeah, I think this woman might have, I think the junior doctor I saw, she might have recognized me from TV. And I think there's a bit of me which thinks that she thought, oh God, I better work hard here, because if he sues, it's going to be a costly thing, because he's on telly and he's probably got loads of money and big lawyers and stuff like that. I don't know. That's me being cynical after reading your books and stuff, I suppose. on that fame thing, it's interesting. One of the bit in your books I absolutely love is the fact that you'd crossed over the line. And anyone who's in the media knows this. Eventually, one day you cross over the line. And the time that you realize that you cross over the line to become a recognizable figure is when you're giving a sperm donation, or whatever you call that in a sperm. You're giving a, what do you call it? Is it sperm? No, it's not a donation, is it? A sperm.
Oh, you make a deposit. I was donating it to my potential future family. Because we'd made the decision that we, you know, down the line, we might want to have kids, and all of the options seem sort of logistically hellishly complicated. But it seemed that a sensible first step would be to see if our sperm were up to the task. And so, because that would determine what route we could go down. And so, went into this place, and I get recognized, I don't know, once a month, because I don't, you know, I don't do a huge amount of telly. I mostly do it when I've got something to plug. Like if a book's come out or a TV show's come out, then okay, fine, I do that. But in general, I say no to, like, will I go on this panel show, because it's just going to increase the chance that someone recognizes me in Ryman's or something. And like, I don't want that. So mostly the people who recognize me, they've spotted like my author photo on the back flap of a book. Yeah. And obviously my photos are about 15 years old when I look sort of much more passable than I do now. So anyway, you've got to be a real, you know, really quite keen fan to spot me. And it happened after I'd left the spunk clinic. I was heading straight for the stairs, and the bloke Brilliant. Outside the door was like, "Oh, loved your book, by the way." Oh no, not today! Come on,
don't Adam, don't
I've
ruin
got
the story.
Enough reasons not to go to the doctors.
But there's more to it than that. The porn that you have to see. Just so read the story, but it's very funny.
It's a lot more high tech than it was when I was working in fertility clinics. It was all very magazine based in my day, and now there's access to actual on screen pornography, which you know it's obviously probably speeds the process up. We get more patients through. It's probably a really good investment by the clinic. But my remote control was broken, and so I was the guy who went in will have seen something that was definitely not to my taste, but I just couldn't change.
There was, because I'm a good person and a good citizen. Once when I was a kid and I'd first started soccer AM, and this was years ago in the late 90s, and I decided that I should go to an STD clinic and get myself tested, you know, and it's like, so I went down to an STD clinic, and you just don't think, it's that thing of when you cross over the line and you don't know. I thought I'm stuck on Sky Sports, no one recognizes me, and I'm sitting in the waiting room of an STD clinic, you know, it's free, and I just went down there for the free, you know, thing that the government are going to give me. And there's some bloke walks in and goes, "Tim, Chelsea fan, what?" I could not have been more mortified than sitting there going, and all you want to do is go, "No, can I tell you why I'm doing this? And I'm not some sort of horrible slag, honestly. Yeah. I'm a good guy."
Well,
you have to sit there talking
hopefully
about.
Times have changed, and there is not there, you know, the stigma and shame of, you know, doing this perfectly normal MOT that all of us should do of going to a sexual health clinic should, it hasn't gone away entirely, but everyone listening should have that on their, you know, on their radar, or something they should do. But that's not, it's not to pretend that anyone particularly wants to be recognized when they're sat in the waiting room.
Yeah, talking about that, a point I was going to make sort of about 26 minutes ago, right at the beginning of this, which is, have you seen Schitt's Creek?
I have,
that
yeah.
Sitcom. Yeah. Have you seen the documentary of it? No, the making
no,
of it?
No, no, not the seen
documentary.
The making of, no.
Right. So there's a documentary at the end, and I really recommend you watch it, where David, who writes it, who's the gay character in it, he gets this letter off this woman going, thank you so much. It makes you cry watching it. Thank you so much, because at last there's a bloody sitcom where you've got gay characters and they're not victims. They're not, there's no point. They're just part of the story. And, you know, and that's what's happening. There's no mention of the fact they're gay, really, apart from the fact that they are gay. And he starts crying and everyone starts crying and I'm watching it crying and thinking, do you know what? That is so important. And I, when I'm reading your book, I thought this is exactly the same as what they did there. Your book is so wonderful. It's such a great read. And you talk about your partner and everything constantly in it. And never is there a point where you feel like you're trying to make it into anything apart from this is just the facts of it. And I think it's a really important book for that. Not only are you talking about the NHS just in a very enjoyable, readable way, you're also talking about being a gay man in a very enjoyable, readable way without any, you know, anything more to it. And I think that's fantastic for that, because that book will end up in people like my parents' hands, who are a lot older and are not used to gay men as much, you know, and it'll end up in my kids' hands who are, and, you know, so it's sort of like, it's wonderful that you've just done that in this book. Were you conscious of that when you were writing it?
That's really kind of you to say, and I'm glad you spotted it, because I think it is really important. And and actually, it was one of the main things when I was making the TV show of This Is Gonna Hurt, that because with all the will in the world, a TV show gets seen by more people than a book ever will. So, you know, it was going out on BBC One, you know, in its first week, I think 8 million people, you know, saw it in the, you know, that episode on iPlayer and BBC One. And like this is a huge chance to, you know, for gay representation, because I think phase one of gay representation on telly is it exists somehow. And so when I was growing up, you know, LGBTQ characters on telly were, being gay or whatever was their defining characteristic. So it was, if the gay character was often quite heightened, and the storyline would be, as you say, about the problems and the struggles or it all came back to being gay, and they couldn't have any other aspect to themselves as a character. I think phase two, which is hopefully where we are now, is that people can just be incidentally gay. And it so happens that at the heart of this TV show, there is a doctor who happens to be gay and his partner, who's a bloke, and they're just a normal, dysfunctional, arguing, ratty couple with the normal problems that couples do, and not majoring on the fact that they're gay. For most of it, you know, it could be interchangeable, that, you know, either of them could be anyone or anything. And I think it just, I don't know if normalizes is the right word, because it is obviously normal to be gay, but it just means that we're totally used to people of all sexualities being on our telly, because that's what life's like. I mean, some of the doctors and nurses and physios you'll have seen, you know, when you were last in hospital, will have been gay. It's just, but they weren't going around saying, oh, I'm gay, by the way, because you don't. Whereas 30 years ago, the gay doctor on telly would have said, oh, I'm gay, by the way, because that's what the show was about.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. I've got this theory that that football, which obviously I was heavily involved with TV shows and stuff, They make such a big thing with sports people and football about coming out. And I've got a theory that it's the media's the problem, not the football fans. Because I think if a player came out, Dave would go, oh, God, you've got a gay bloke playing for you. You know, John and Steve would go, oh, fuck off, mate. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It doesn't matter anymore, you know. But I think the media, the problem is if you come out, you're then the circus of, you know, so you know, you're John and you're playing for Spurs and you come out, or Chelsea or whatever, you come out, then the media is just on you constantly going, the gay player, the gay player, the gay player. Well, you can't just be gay and play football. You have to be the gay player. And I think that's the problem, is kind of the media, the way the media would deal with it. Because I think the fans would just go, you know, if you were someone's teammate and you had a go at them, you would soon be cancelled and never play football again.
Oh, yeah, so that it would totally self-police. I think the problem is, the reason that it is a story is because it is so rare at the moment. And we need, what you sort of need is, you know, the 20 people who are currently hiding their sexuality in the Premier League need to all come out at once. And then, you know, and so that after that, then there's no interest in the 43rd openly gay top flight football player. Of course there isn't. It's just, it's like, you know, there's no interest in a writer or an actor being gay, because there's plenty of us, you know, out there. So, it has to change. I did speak to
a footballer about this once, and he said to me, the problem is your worth goes down. So you know, you're playing for, I don't know, whoever, West Brom or someone, and you say, yeah, I'm openly gay footballer, then Chelsea and Man United and stuff go, can't be arsed with the circus which comes with it. And so your worth goes down, apparently. That's what the thought process is, because do you want the media attention on that? And the managers are all desperately trying not to lose their jobs constantly, so they don't need anything else to add into the equation, is the way that it's being perceived, which is very sad, I think.
It has to change. And it will change. It has to. 10 years' time, when we're having this conversation, hopefully it will just be such a minor thing.
Yeah.
It has to change. There can't be these pockets of society where it's somehow acceptable to your industry to make you hide who you are.
But then, I suppose, why should, for such a short period of time in their career, why should they be asked to do it? What is it? You know, why? If I was Tim, gay footballer, why the hell would I know I'm going to retire at 33 or something? Why the hell would I waste my life having to deal with all that shit where I could just get on and play football, then come out later on? And I suppose that's what's happening out there.
It's a big personal decision.
It is.
And it worked for employers who were actually caring and were actually nurturing and actually wanted them to, you know, that you can always make a reason why you shouldn't come out.
We all know football doesn't have those values, mate.
That's true. I mean, I think that's the underlying issue, potentially.
Yeah. It is. But on talking about being a great journalist, I'm going to move swiftly back to your book and say, in your book, there's a lot of stuff in there where I'm going, hold on, that's quite in-depth stuff there you're writing about. Was that a tough decision to make? I mean, by the way, I think we've got to explain, the book is sort of a bit about being in medicine and then a lot about when you come out of medicine and decide to become the comic and the writer and everything else. But also there's a lot of stuff about family issues in there as well. And that's quite a big subject to talk about, isn't it?
I do definitely cover some big stuff. And, you know, I talk about there's some stuff I've talked about in there that none of my friends knew about. There's stuff in there that my husband found out for the first time when he didn't have to wait until it came out on the bookshelves, but when I wrote my first draft, showed him, and I talk about some tough stuff that men don't necessarily talk about a lot, that doctors definitely don't talk about a lot. I talk about an assault. I talk about an eating disorder, and I talk about them very openly. And, you know, they very nearly didn't make it into the book, but I'm glad I put them in the book, because I've had messages from people saying, I read that and then I'm getting help, and I read that and that helped me, and I read that and I was glad I wasn't alone in that. And so, and what I haven't had at all was hate. And I thought that, I didn't know how it was going to happen. I was trying to persuade myself probably not to open up. But so I thought that, you know, I would have all this stuff hurled at me as a result. But in fact, that was just in my head. And the response I've had has been really, really generous and heartwarming.
Oh, it's Oh, it's a fantastic read, but yeah, quite harrowing in places, but you always do it with comedy. So for the reader's perspective, it's nice because when it's going like, oh God, I'm not sure I want to carry on reading this. And then you always throw lovely light comedy in there. So it's always a pleasurable read. Was it therapeutic then writing this book for you? Did you find that you managed to exercise some demons by doing it?
Yes, I did. So when I left medicine in the first place, I'm pretty sure I had some form of PTSD. So I left medicine, a very bad thing happened while I was the most senior doctor on a labour ward, and it haunted my dreams. I'd left medicine, I was waking up in the middle of the night, pulse going 200 beats a minute, covered in sweat, unable to get back to sleep, not even wanting to get back to sleep in case I returned to that nightmare. And that continued and continued and continued all the way until the first time I've talked about it. And that was basically when my first book, This Is Gonna Hurt, came out. And then I would be invited, you know, I would go on stage and I would talk about it. And I'd chat to journalists and I'd talk about it. And then, as if by magic, things started to get better. And I'm a very bad patient, like I was saying, not just when it comes to my physical health, but also when it comes to my mental health. And I'd sort of done a one-man experiment proving that if you speak about stuff, it helps. I'd basically prove to myself that the concept of therapy is a good one, something that I'd always sort of shied away from. If I'm the sort of person who doesn't seek help, when I have a spinal injury and I can't move my right leg, am I really going to go to a doctor and say, I'm really struggling right now? So I knew that it would be good to get down, and I'm now much better at seeking help. And the people I speak to about my mental health were very supportive of the idea of putting stuff down, because then it's out there. Like you say, exercise your demons. It's very cathartic, and I'm glad I've done it.
The thing is, though, with it, you've got to have very supportive people around you, haven't you? Because immediately your partner has to get involved, and your parents have to get involved, and anyone who's reading your book will understand, who have been there. They're all involved, and so there's that process you have to, you have to square that off, don't you, in your mind, that by saying this, I'm bringing all those people into my story as well.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, and but you can and should, if you're struggling, speak to someone, even if you don't think you do have the network around you. You know, I'm lucky in the relationship I'm in and with the friends I've got. But a lot of people get in touch with me to say, I don't have anywhere to turn. And the truth is that you always do have places to turn. And I wonder if it's possible in the show notes that go along with the podcast, if we could put down a couple of helplines people can contact rather than me just rattling off some numbers. But there are places for people to go, and knowing that there is a shoulder to cry on, knowing that there is a person who will get it, knowing that there is a person who can offer some practical advice, the person who can say, it maybe isn't as bad as you think it is right now. You feel very helpless when you're in a dark place, as of course you know, and everyone listening knows, but knowing the direction of travel is often the hardest thing.
When you joined the NHS, you know, you went for obviously birth, which is fantastic. You didn't choose dermatology or something, which is easier to get your head around, because you don't, I'm sure not many people die of a skin rash. But you obviously
witnessed. I mean, they do. I mean, there's no such thing as I don't think dermatology is easier, but what it is you get less covered in blood and there are fewer emergencies. But, you know, you can still, you know, your patients die if you say that was a mole and that was a melanoma. You've potentially killed a patient. But it was very, I mean, what I did is I went for the, I ended up going right on the front line, the sort of cutting edge bit. But the mistake I'd made was I was drawn by the height of the highs, and I hadn't realized that that would always be offset by the depth of the lows. Because, I mean, you end up with twice the number of patients you start with. I mean, that is absolutely unique in medicine. And I worked in infertility clinics as well. Couples who a few decades ago, it would have been impossible, the concept of them having kids. Now, amazing technologies mean that it's very rare to be able to say to a couple, we can't help you. Because, I mean, aside from the finances of it, which is another big discussion. But and so I was drawn by all that. And I never really thought too much about what do the bad days look like. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's traumatic. Seeing any death is traumatic. And it's one of those weird things that I'm not sure we appreciate how much death you have to see when you work in medicine. And then I wonder if your view on life and death is different from most of us because you saw more than us. You saw more babies being born, and you saw some babies who didn't make it. And so I wonder if you've changed the way you view life and death.
Yes, by definition, the job changes you. And almost from day one, not even day one on the job, day one of medical school, you know, I was an 18-year-old, you know, as discussed, having sort of been very poorly introduced to society at that point. And I was cutting up a dead body within my first week, standing around a cadaver. And then being instructed, you know, take the scalpel, make an incision here, turn left, go under the ribs, reflect that flap of skin, you know, get your nutcrackers, go through the rib. That is not normal. And it's probably, I'd say it's not acceptable, but it desensitizes you. I think perhaps that's the function of making these young prospective doctors, do this dissection, is so that they desensitize to the concept rather than what they're actually learning about the anatomical structures in front of them. And then you've got that, and then they say, and now off to the bar. It's a deliberately, the culture is baked in as work hard, play hard. Like my medical school literally had a bar within the hospital. I mean, you could be on a ward, and without going outside, you can end up with a pint in your hand, which I did regularly. We all did. So, what we weren't actually taught were any healthy coping mechanisms. We taught how to break bad news, taught how to deal with an aggressive patient. Never once taught how I myself should deal with the consequences of breaking bad news. And of course, it's nowhere near as bad for the healthcare provider as for the patient or the family. How can it be? But there is always, you know, something in something you get back, something reflects back at you. And so, yeah, I think of life and death very differently. I realize how fragile life is. I know what the doctors are thinking when they're saying whatever they're saying, and
Adam,
for better or worse.
You sort of touched on it a minute ago, but your book is really kind of like it's like a self-help book, really, in a way, because you can see the extremes you went through, kind of trapped, really, with the sort of career that you didn't want to do, sort of living a heterosexual life when you didn't want to, and then the eating disorders and the cold sweats and everything else that you were suffering because of that. You must feel amazingly free now as a person, that you're doing something you truly love and you're brilliant at writing, and also you're gay and you've got a partner, and you're happy to talk about it, you're happy to discuss it. It must be the most freeing experience. You must feel amazing now, do you?
I mean, it is obviously great, and I'm hugely lucky in all sorts of ways with my work and my personal life both. But I'm now at, I think, what should be everyone's default setting.
Right.
You know, so if you're, you know, if you're straight, you don't, you know, say a prayer every morning giving thanks for being able to be happily straight in the world. And I'm now doing a job that I enjoyed medicine, but it was at the same time destroying me, or I wasn't the right person to be in that branch of medicine, whatever it is. But equally, we should be in a world where everyone is happy going to work. And I am obviously grateful to be in that position, because it is a rarefied position. But I'm glad I'm not where I was in a couple of ways, where I was sort of, there were things that were hidden and buttoned up, because whoever you are, whether you're a doctor or a footballer, it isn't great going around knowing you've got big secrets, knowing that if someone asks you a question, you have to lie. It's having to remember what the lie that you've decided is about, you know, about your sexuality or whatever it is. So, or your eating disorder, or, you know, which, you know, that involved, I've lied more than I ever did in my life about, you know, when that was an issue when I was a medical student, to my flatmates about how I'd just eaten on the way out, and, oh, I can't make dinner tonight because I've got to, you know, this phone call with someone. And so, yeah, it is definitely freeing. Do I feel amazing? I don't know.
And I think the more and more, there's more evidence that if you are holding in lies and you are living a lie, that you're going to get ill. There's more evidence that the body holds it all in, doesn't there? And it's like, you know, as you say, you end up with eating disorders or stress, or, you know, it manifests itself in generally illness. You're not able to do it. So to be freeing, like you have, must be liberating. But also it's an important lesson for everyone. If you are doing that, I'd recommend you read Adam Kay's book, because it just makes you feel happy about how he's gone with his life and how he's done that. But there was one bit in it which was the most shocking bit to me, and I know it's shocking to some of your friends who've read the book, and, you know, there's a lot of really in-depth detailed stuff in there, but the one of the, you know, thing I had to reread it again was, you support West Ham. You're a football fan, Adam. I mean, like, and all the, you know, all this stuff you write about, you know, eating disorders, you know, and all that sort of stuff.
Well, I talk a lot about shame and stigma, and then, you know, I do love West Ham.
Adam, what I thought was so funny is I read it and I went, what? You're a West Ham fan? And then the next thing you wrote, because you are brilliant, you went, and my mates were like, this is the most shocking thing in the book. And that's what I was thinking. What? Where did that come from? You're a West Ham fan. It's brilliant.
I think I generally receive warmth when people know I support West Ham, because West Ham, it's fair to say, aren't a huge threat if you support another top flight team. We're not. You don't need to worry us about worrying you for the title. So
it's fantastic. That's really good. Listen, Adam, we've come to the end of the hour. Just the final thing I want to do is, I was trying to make a list. You said you're the Britain's 13th best known doctor in your book. I started with the 12th, and 13th, and I was trying to do it. And I'm not. I've got Dr. Martin, and I've got Dr. Martin as in boots. I've got Doctor Who. Doctor on the telly, Chris something on this morning, and I've got Dr. Legg from EastEnders, and Dr. No, and Dr. Watson. I'm not sure of any other doctors I could come up with. Really,
well, there's Dr. Pepper, Dr. Dre, Dr. Oertke. Yeah, Dr.
Dre. Hold on, Dr. Pepper's American.
He's American. Oh, no, you're right. Yeah, no, sorry.
You did say UK.
Yeah, so I mean, Operation Ouch already. We've got Dr. Chris, Dr. Zand, and Dr. Ronks. So that's three. We've got Dr. Ranch. I mean, he was on Strictly.
You're more famous than them. Oh, maybe not Dr. Ranch. No, he did Strictly.
No, I can't compete with them.
I think you're on everybody's radar these days, because the books, you know, when I bought the books, the Kay's Anatomy and Kay's Medicine, what was it? Kay's Something Medicine?
Kay's Marvelous Medicine.
Sorry, I'm so bad. Marvelous Medicine, yeah. Those two books, I gave them, the first one, I have to say, I bought it from my daughter. She took it to school and she went, oh my God, Dad, all the boys are reading this book as well, like that. And they'd all got it and they were all reading it. Aww. So everyone knows you from that. And then when I got a Marvelous Medicine, it was sent to me as a preview. I gave it to her and she took it to school to show off that she she had the book. It was the most Aww. Exciting thing that had ever happened, that she had it before it was out in the shops, you know, a couple of weeks before it was out in the shop. But we just sat every night reading through it. Her face just lit up reading that book. It was just wonderful. And what was more is... Adam, I learned so much from reading that book that I didn't know, because you know, obviously we know bugger all as well as adults. You know, I know nothing about the human anatomy. It's absolutely fantastic. I recommend those two for Christmas presents for kids. They're fantastic.
Oh, thank you. Like, it claims to be for 7 to 12-year-olds, but the truth of it is, it's mostly for the parents who never totally understood quite how the lungs work or what hemoglobin is from GCSE biology 30 years ago.
But the other one is Marvelous Medicines, the unbelievable sort of stuff that we used to think about the human body. Some of it lasted for thousands of years. Doctors were still doing it. And you write about it in your book. They were still doing it years ago before, you know, and it's like you're reading that going, holy shit, they used to believe that stuff. It's unbelievable. So I wonder if the stuff we're believing now is also going to be proved 100%. To be absolute bullshit.
Like, for example, the brain, we know so little about the brain. I think even in 20 years' time, there's going to... medical students are going to be looking back at today's textbook going, they thought what? So anyway, all this to come.
Adam, have you done the audiobook which goes along with this, Undoctored?
I have, yeah. No, I read that. I got away with it. I think it sounds all right. It took me a very long time. I'm not one of nature's audiobook readers, but I was glad I read it because it's a very personal story, and even though Stephen Fry or Tim Lovejoy would do a much better job than I would,
I'm the rubbish at doing stuff like that. No, I am. But listen, this book is fantastic. I recommend it to anyone. Don't watch Netflix. Instead, pick up this book and give it a read, because you will be thoroughly entertained and you will learn stuff. It's called Undoctored by Adam Kay. Thanks for joining me, Adam.
Thank you so much.